Hello and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 65. Today is April the 16th, 2008. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind where we get our information from. Each week, new segments on Unbought and Unbossed offers further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either ignored or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. You. The global elite see Canadian citizens as mere profit-creating consumers at best and at worst, disposable muscle men to help steal the remaining pockets of natural resources they do not yet control. Don't fool yourself by underestimating the importance of Canadian natural resources and our colonial past. Canada has long been a player in this international political system that favors the ultra-rich. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. Sign on. And that's what I got to say. So, welcome to Unbought, Unbossed, show number 65. This week, in the second hour, an interview with Richard Gage, an architect. He's going to be speaking in our part of the world here in Vancouver and Victoria on April 19th and 20th. I'll be talking more about that, have some PAs to play for that as well. Let me see, this would be a really good person to, if you want to call up a buddy and say, hey, you know, this pretty important speaker, you know, talking about the problems in the official 9/11 story from an architectural perspective. So, fantastic. Also, I'm going to be taking a look at the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. H.R. 1955, that's often referred to as. Now, this ties into Richard Gage as well. Their website, ae911truth.org, has been labeled darn it, I don't have the information at hand in front of me, in a congressional subcommittee meeting in November of 07, their website, ae911truth.org, highlighted as a homegrown terrorist possibility. Very scary stuff. So I'm going to discuss this bill, and we're going to hear two audio clips discussing it as well. And this first one is just entitled Freedom of Speech. And this comes from Brass Check TV, and that's a fantastic place that is putting out many videos a week. This one here is by Goodman Green, and that's an 8-minute track, and Richard Gage is featured in this track. Another one I'm going to play by an unknown woman, I guess you'd call it a vlog, a video blog, and she's talking about this H.R. Bill H.R. 1955. So, what else? Announcement. Faulkner Books, downtown Nanaimo, at Port Place Mall, is indeed a good place to pick up your 9/11 truth literature. He's ordered books on my recommendation, and so I think that's pretty cool. You know, independent media and radio, you know, collaborating with independent bookseller. So well done to us. Last week, I had Patrick Borden on as an interview guest. He's one of the directors of the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society. And I'm telling you that because I want you to note that I do archive my shows, and you can listen to them either streaming or download them for when you're out and about. So I will give you a web address, unbossed.livejournal.com. That's unbossed.livejournal.com. And if you'd like to contact me, my email address is radioshow4911truth@hotmail.com. Radio Show for 9/11 Truth, and that's F-O-R. Also, I want to tell you what we're listening to in the background is a track called In the Morning We Cry by an outfit called Prophecies of War. Played it first last week, and I liked it so much I'm, you know, playing it for my opening piece here. And another neat thing is that I'm going to have the producer and musician from this project, Andrew Hanna. He's in Philadelphia. And this project, Prophecies of War, is really a multimedia production blending several music genres and media, as such as video projection and audio clips, of Dwight D. Eisenhower and George W. Bush, which tells the story of Eisenhower's last speech to the nation and the chain of events that followed, which is, of course, the military-industrial congressional complex. That's the warning that was given. So let's listen to that for a sec. So again, Andrew Hanna from Philadelphia will be next week's guest. Now a quote here. This I first saw it as an email tag from Matthew of the 9/11 March on Canada email group, and this is a fantastic quote, and it's by former Prime Minister John G. Diefenbaker, and he, in case you don't know, was our 13th Prime Minister between the years of 1957 and 1963. And here's the quote. I am a Canadian, free to speak without fear, free to worship in my own way, free to stand for what I think right, free to oppose what I believe wrong, and free to choose those who shall govern my country. This heritage of freedom I pledge to uphold for myself and all mankind. So I'm really impressed with that, you know, that free to speak without fear, free to stand up for what I think right, free to oppose what I believe wrong. Wow, great ideas, and there's a lot of people that, you know, that's still their version of Canada, and thank goodness. I'm meeting a lot of great people in this truth community, and, you know, there is hope for us. You naysayers, I think things are turning around. I really do. I think something's going to budge in Canada in the coming months. Okay, let's move on now, and I'll get back to you, and we're going to talk about this violent radicalization of homegrown terrorism prevention act of 2007. So we'll be back in a little while with that. We're going to listen to Broken Levee Blues by DJ Shadow as well after this Richard Gage announcement, which was made by the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society. Here it is.
Do you still have unanswered questions about the official theory of 9/11? Did two airplanes really knock down three World Trade Center buildings? Can jet fuel really melt grade A steel? Was a skyscraper brought down by fire for the first time in history? Did 19 young Arabs, led by a guy in a cave, really defeat the entire U.S. military? In the Architecture of Destruction, a blueprint for truth, architect Richard Gage presents answers to these questions and more. Presented by the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society at the Vancouver Public Library, Saturday, April 19th, 7 p.m. For tickets and information, go to Vancouver911Truth.org.
What do you say to people who have no homes? Is it Astrodome or Superdome or move in with a relative? But then that's relative when you have to move from NO to Alaska or Utah and you saw how they feel about you on the news.
Was DJ Shadow Broken Levee Blues. Let's talk about this HR 1955. I was going to say it was very complicated, but I've tried to wrap it up in as small a package as I can here. Perhaps Richard Gage can speak on this topic as well. So this H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, is a bill that was sponsored by Representative Jane Hartman of California. Its stated purpose is to deal with homegrown terrorism and violent radicalization. And what they have done, this was passed in October 23rd, 2007. And so its purpose is to establish, firstly, a national commission, secondly, establishing a center of study, sounds like another, conservative think tank idea exchange, and thirdly, well, to cooperate with other nations. I don't hold too much stock in that idea. But a national commission and a center for study is going to come out of this to keep an eye on the dangerous persons in the States and on the Internet. Now, one of the things that's important about this bill is that it defines some important terms. First off, what the heck is violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence. Now, of course, giving definitions to this has provoked much controversy in some quarters. Unfortunately, not in the mainstream press. Of course, they don't really cover this. However, the bill does say that it specifically prohibits, this is a quote, the violation of civil rights and liberties in the enforcement of the bill. But critics of the bill say that this bill will indeed pave the way for violations of civil rights and liberties. And that is part of the problem. You know, the potential of where this could lead to is absolutely frightening. You know, with these monsters that are controlling, you know, U.S. policy, you put that together with this, you know, the potential abuse of this bill, and look out. We, you know, people are saying police state, you know. I mean, they have been for a little while, but, you know, this is, you know, a firm brick in that wall. So, carrying on. So, I guess to summarize the bill here, I've dropped it down to looking at its provisions here. Now, the bill, if enacted, would, firstly, amend the Homeland Security Act of 2002 and add these provisions concerning the prevention of homegrown terrorism. And you know what? I'm really fearful that, you know, these brave, patriotic people that I was referring to, the truth movement in general, are indeed falling under this homegrown terrorism umbrella. And, you know, like I was telling you about Richard Gage's website. So, another provision is that it directs the Secretary of Homeland Security to do a couple things. Firstly, establish a grant program to prevent radicalization and homegrown terrorism in the United States. Secondly, to establish or designate a university-based center of excellence. Hard to say that without a little chuckle there. A center of excellence for the study of radicalization and homegrown terrorism in the United States. So it's not going to be an okay center. It's going to be an excellent center of study. And, you know, a lot of money is going to go into that, isn't it? You know, that's where our taxes are going. You know, just building up this this complex. Another provision. Right, this is a good one. And I really like that they added this in to, you know, all the naysayers like, you know, myself, that these guys are, you know, they're Americans, by golly. You know, they wouldn't do anything bad. So they included this. Thirdly, they are going to prohibit the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to prevent ideologically based violence and homegrown terrorism from violating the Constitution and our civil rights and civil liberties. So, you know, they are promising here that that will not happen. You know, they've thought it through, and they want to include that. So what can we do? We can take a look at some of these definitions, these terms that I believe this is the first time that, you know, through these bills that these terms have been identified and defined. For example, homegrown terrorism. What is that? Well, it is the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individual born, raised, or based and operating primarily within the United States or any possession of the United States. So, to intimidate or coerce the United States government, the civilian population of the United States, or any segment thereof, in furtherance of political or social objectives. Now, that's a pretty long definition. Let me take it down to the meat. First off, it's the use of force or violence with the intent to intimidate or coerce for the furtherance of political or social objectives. So that is, now keep in mind, force or violence. But that's a pretty broad definition, isn't it? What exactly does force mean? Does force mean, you know, handing out truth DVDs or having a truth radio show? I certainly hope not. You know, the violence, absolutely not. I'm 100% against violence in, you know, in most every case. So, you know, if it's all good then, isn't it? But another definition here. This will be the last one. Ideologically based violence. Now, that one's a little more succinct. And it is the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence, so the same again, by a group or individual to promote the group's or individual's political, religious, or social beliefs. So that is, once again, force or violence to promote one's beliefs is ideologically based violence. So says this bill. Now, of course, this bill has come under a lot of criticism, as it very well should. Unfortunately, it's not coming from the government or the corporate media. I believe this bill was voted, there was only 6 people opposed to it, so, you know, overwhelmingly voted in favor of. That's not a good sign, is it? So, points of criticism. Now, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee describes common concerns that are much maligned as the Joe McCarthy rides again. You know, this communist witch hunt that went down 50 years ago, well, it's back, and they've just replaced the word communism with terrorism. So, well done, Defense Committee, or Bill of Rights Defense Committee. So this is a $22 million boondoggle, an idea to create yet another government entity to study an overblown threat already addressed by a $44 billion a year U.S. intelligence community. So that's what the Bill of Rights Defense Committee had to say about this. Now, critics charge that the vagueness of these definitions would permit the government to classify many types of venerated American political activity, such as civil disobedience, and turn that into terrorism. You know, protests, things like that, that there's the possibility that that can be labeled as terrorism. You know, is that group of people trying to coerce or influence the government? Absolutely, of course they are. You know, that's what any mass get-together is. So, you know, that's herein lies the problem. Now, they argue that these critics in general here, I should tell you, much of the notes from this came from Wikipedia. They argue that major societal reforms, which are now accepted but were perceived at the time as threatening to the government. Now, that's a really neat point, you know, such as the civil rights movement, suffrage, voting, you know, and, you know, other forms of, you know, political activity could now be labeled as terrorism. So that's really neat. You know, things that, you know, without hindsight, you know, now we're going, wow, how could it have been that way, you know? Yeah, you know, reforms which are now accepted but were perceived at the time as threatening to the government. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another source of concerns centers around a series of congressional findings from a House subcommittee meeting held November 6, 2007. And what happened here, 9/11 truthers know where I'm going with this, is that this subcommittee heard testimony which equated the 9/11 truth movement with terrorist propaganda. You know, and Richard Gage has been speaking out, you know, demanding an explanation of how could you put the his science-based collection of professionals, and you're labeling us, you know, homegrown terrorists, or, you know, something of the such. So obviously, enter Richard Gage. We'll get his, you know, he's been, obviously, he's looked into this issue, hasn't he? So that's going to be really exciting. You know, and I'll conclude by, you know, talking about what has been the media reaction to this bill. Well, I guess I've already alluded to this, is that the mainstream press is pretty much ignoring this issue, you know, with a few noted exceptions, but you're going to learn about this through the internet primarily. You know, so it is the independent alternative press. There we are. What we're going to do now is move on to our first audio piece on this bill. I took this off of YouTube, and this is by an unknown woman. She doesn't identify herself. She's every woman. And it was a vlog, a video blog, and this woman suggests that freedom of speech is or could be over, and that a police state is being built up before ours, and that she has been talking about this to her friends and to strangers and to anyone who will listen, and she doesn't feel like she's being listened to, and she's pretty upset, and she's calling for a general wake up, as so many of us are. So that's where we're going to go to just after this Richard Gage PSA again from the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society. This was one of their internet video commercials. So Richard Gage coming up, and then this unknown woman talking about Bill H.R. 1955.
Buildings are destroyed by a number of different forces, each having very different identifiable characteristics. How does this happen? We have 24 core and 57 perimeter columns around this building. What could make all 81 of these columns fail simultaneously?
I think I know an explosion when I hear it.
So why didn't we see the truth about 9/11? Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any significance in the major media. That's a hell of a statement to be made by the head of the CIA. Evidence of explosives. Unfortunately, it's not just the buildings. Wherever you go in the official story, you find holes, huge holes. Your worldview is not the same as it was 2 hours ago.
H.R. 1955, Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorist Prevention Act of 2007. It's Halloween night. I've been drinking, having a good time. The entire night I was out, all I could think about was this bill. I tried to spread the word. Not many people listened, but two out of a crowd of 300 would listen. This bill will bring an end to America as we know it. Basically, our freedom of speech is done. Dissension, there will be a police state. Anything spoken against the social standards permitted by the government, you will be considered a criminal, a terrorist, according to this bill. The wording is so vague. There are so many loose ends that if the Senate passes this, it's going to be so detrimental to our existence as an American citizen as we know it. Nobody will listen to me. Nobody. My family, my friends, my husband. They all think I'm a joke. I'm just rambling on, right? Because I'm taking part in something I believe in. So it's not worth listening to, I guess. My son is experiencing this, as we know. I'm reading through this right now. My son's going through something with school where he's not allowed to write about war, death, fire, weapons, sadness. Nothing that doesn't conform to their social standard. It's already happening. But this bill is going to finalize it. But it's already happening with our children. You're just not paying attention, or maybe your child hasn't written about something yet that they consider controversial, like my son, who's been profiled again and again because of the fact that he has a quiet demeanor, he's reclusive, and he likes to write about the tragedies that surround him. 9/11, the possibility of a nuclear war, losing people in a nightclub fire everything affects our children, and they need to express this. They need to write in a creative element. They need to write for the cathartic element, basically. And our schools are not letting them do that. And whatever. I might be shit-faced, but you know what? This shit is on my mind 24/7, whether I'm shit-faced or not. And right now, because I've been drinking, it's only just making that emotion so much stronger. And it's the only emotion I feel, no matter what I do in my life, is the well-being of our country, of our people, of our civil liberties, everything. It's over. It's over with this bill. If we let this bill pass, please, people, you know, I implore you, you have to contact Congress. It's already passed the House. Go to your senators, the ones that are likely to stand for your opinion. Ted Kennedy is not, he's not going to say no. He's going to say yes. Patrick Kennedy in Rhode Island, who is a representative in the House, already said yay. So likely he did that because Daddy told him to. So if you live in the state of Massachusetts, I suggest that you contact Kerry. Representative, what's his name, Barney Frank, the gay one, he voted for it because he was obviously fooled by the wording in this, which he probably believes that it only protects gay rights. And it goes beyond that. It goes beyond hate crimes. This is basically a thought crime bill. You think something against what they approve, and you are gone. You are considered a domestic terrorist, and we need to wake up now.
Nobody talking when I'm talking, fellas, so shut the fuck up. Following items you place in the envelope as I call them off. An empty wallet. Legal paperwork. First three out of the tank.
Line up a single file on the bench. Let's go. You open your mouth. Stick out your tongue. Right, do your ears, one at a time. Okay, bend your hands over. Shake them out with your fingers. Hands above your head. Hands out in front of you. Over. With those fingers. Reach down and lift up your nutsack. Drop your nutsack, skip back your dick. Turn around. 1 foot at a time. Pick it up and wiggle the toes. Other foot. Okay, bend over. Grab your ass. Spread your cheeks and give me two good cops.
Okay, I couldn't help but play that. You know, that woman was talking about some pretty scary things, and what we heard after that was a track called The First Day of School, and that's by Ice Cube. That's an older, maybe off his second solo CD, and what he's talking about is the police state that's already a reality for a lot of people in the states, in the inner cities. That is his reality, and you know, I think this woman was trying to say that that might be where we're going for all of us. There we are. I want to move on again to that second and final audio track, looking at the bill, H.R. 1955. And this one here is put together by Goodman Green and collaborated with Brass Check TV. And in this, Richard Gage is in this audio clip as well, talking about the bill. Now, what Goodman is saying is that there is a very real potential to undermine the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with this bill, and that asking questions and seeking answers is not terrorism. You know, no way will, you know, people who know me, you know, fall for that, you know, if the government starts calling me a terrorist. So you know, and that's, you know, we know better. You know, we can't. Oh boy, I feel so sorry for the people in the States. You know, almost as bad as I feel for the countries that the American military is bombing. You know, but Canada is not faring too well on that either. You know, except for the countries being bombed with, you know, weapons. You know, after the States, Canada is the most affected nation, I would say. You know, you're not going to learn about this by watching your television. You're not going to learn about this by watching, you know, reading your daily newspaper. That's hugely unfortunate. You know, you have to have a free press to have a democracy. And, you know, that's why we don't have a free press. You know, it's set up that way to, you know, disguise that we have a democracy. But, you know, those who, you know, are doing your homework, you don't know this. And we just have to pass this knowledge on. So here we are. We're going to listen to a piece called Freedom of Speech. And this was found at Brass Check TV. Look them up. They're a fantastic. Give them your email address, and they're going to send you a fantastic video most every day. Many of them, well, actually all of them are worth watching. So there we are. Okay, let's do that now.
On November 7th, 2007, Mark Weitzman, representing the Simon Wiesenthal Center, spoke before the Homeland Security Subcommittee and Jane Harman, author of the bill H.R. 1955. The meeting was titled Using the Web as a Weapon, the Internet as a Tool for Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism. Mr. Weitzman very directly labeled the peaceful 9/11 truth movement as extremist and associated it with violent criminals like terrorists.
One of the things that we have discovered is that some of the methods used by both our homegrown extremists as well as international extremists are the same. By trying to appeal to a closed group, that is, create a closed environment, they help influence the process of radicalization, as has been described earlier. Some of these are conspiracy theories that present a closed view of the world, such as blaming 9/11 as in part of an outside job or a job by outside groups, such as the U.S. government. We must have increased cooperation internationally among the political, law enforcement, NGO, academic, and all other interested sectors. There must be the political will to legally act when necessary.
He then went on to display in a PowerPoint presentation web pages from the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth website. He gave them a rather prominent place among some truly nasty, radical jihadist websites and other websites advocating violence. The implication being that peacefully asking questions and demanding answers is terrorism. This is not a hateful website. This is a group of 241 architects and engineers that have serious and educated questions that were not answered by the FEMA or NIST reports. And in the case of Building 7, weren't even asked. Why would Mr. Weitzman accuse these architectural and engineering professionals of spreading disinformation and label them terrorists? They are American citizens. They are educated professionals within their respective fields. And they are activists petitioning Congress for an investigation of the questions raised by their findings. There are no threats posted here, no joy expressed at horrible losses, only genuine concern that truly valuable evidence was overlooked in existing reports. You can see for yourself at ae911truth.org that there is no violent radicalization going on here. Terrorists don't ask Congress to investigate things, and they certainly don't have web pages listing their names and upcoming speaking engagements. Terrorists mask their identities, hide in shadows, and do bad things. Whether you support the truth movement or not, whether you like the questions they are asking or not, I am sure that you understand asking questions and raising awareness of these questions is not terrorism.
Is it constitutional? Is it American to shut down those who ask questions and demand answers and demand justice, which is all the 9/11 truth movement is seeking to do and all architects and engineers are seeking to do? What is being attempted here is to tie science-based organizations such as ae911truth.org to terror sites and 9/11 conspiracies and disinformation. Now, all we're showing is the science. There's no doctored videos here. There's no disinformation. Everything we show is backed up and referenced. And had Mark Weitzman looked at our site before he put it up there, he certainly would have seen that that is the case.
Critics of H.R. 1955 have pointed out that the very loose language of the bill could label freedom of speech and other nonviolent forms of political opposition as homegrown terrorism. An interesting point, considering that Mr. Weitzman slandered the 9/11 Truth Movement before the Homeland Security Subcommittee. Proponents of the bill, and those that simply doubt the danger of legally defining homegrown terrorism so loosely, argue that the bill would merely establish a harmless commission to investigate ways to prevent violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism. I'm afraid my concerns aren't dismissed as easily. With talking heads calling for the criminalization of free speech and labeling political campaigns domestic threats, with Mark Weitzman implying to the Homeland Security Subcommittee that 9/11 truth is terrorism, and with the term homegrown terrorism being so loosely defined as to potentially include free speech, I still have some concerns. Calling it a commission does not make it harmless. Google the McCarran Internal Security Act of 1950 sometime and read up on it. It established a subversive activities control board and authorized concentration camps for emergency situations. President Truman vetoed it, calling it the greatest danger to freedom of speech, press, and assembly since the Alien and Sedition Laws of 1798. But his veto was overridden by an overwhelming majority in the Congress. It became a law, many sections of which were only years later found to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court and repealed.
There never has been a more futile political movement in the United States than that of communism. After 25 years, they can't get enough votes to keep the name on the ballot. This idea of finding a communist owner under the bed seems to me all nonsense. And the result of the whole thing is that Americans now are so timid about expressing themselves that we've practically given up democratic methods and free speech.
Another one to look into is the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was responsible for the famous Hollywood blacklist. According to the Teaching Eleanor Roosevelt Glossary, the House Un-American Activities Committee was created in 1938 to investigate alleged disloyalty and subversive activities on the part of private citizens, public employees, and those organizations suspected of having communist ties. Through its power to subpoena witnesses and hold people in contempt of Congress, the committee often pressured witnesses to surrender names and other information. Committee members often branded witnesses as communists if they refused to comply, and sometimes charged them with contempt, denying them their Fifth Amendment right not to testify against themselves. And the blacklists were lists of professionals who were denied employment in their field because of their political beliefs or associations, real or suspected. It caused direct damage to the careers of many Americans, often made betrayal of friendship the price of livelihood, and promoted ideological censorship across the entire country. The questioning style and examination techniques employed by the committee served as the model upon which Senator Joseph McCarthy would conduct his communist witch hunts in the early 1950s. McCarthy learned from the House Un-American Activities Committee that baseless accusations, defamation, and guilt by association could ruin lives and make anyone suspect. McCarthy's tactics and his inability to substantiate his claims led to his being discredited and censured by the United States Senate. Having passed the House of Representatives, H.R. 1955 now sits in the Senate in the form of S. 1959. Establishing a commission is not harmless, not new, and little has changed. The Red Scare is now the terror warning. Communism is now terrorism. And asking questions is now violent radicalization. Please look into these and other similarities on your own and recognize the threat to freedom of speech that S. 1959 poses. If you recognize the similarities as I do, then write, call, and email your senators right away. It's not that hard to do, and it only takes a few minutes. Tell them that they must find another way to combat real threats that do not undermine the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that asking questions and seeking answers is not terrorism. And tell them now, while it's still safe to speak out.
Hey, welcome.
welcome back. You're listening to Unbought and Unbossed on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. It is 8:47 p.m. Wednesday. Let's move on to the campus community updates. Brought to you in part by Edmonton 911 Truth. Thank you very much, Edmonton. Okay, well, of course, the big news is Richard Gage is going to be in Victoria this coming Sunday, April the 20th at 2 p.m. at St. John the Divine Anglican Church. And he will be in Vancouver the evening before, April the 19th, which is a Saturday. That is an evening show at the Downtown Public Library. I believe it's 8 o'clock. Cost, I believe, Vancouver 8, Victoria suggestion of 10, but no one will be turned away. Very cool to that. As you know, or maybe don't know, Richard Gage is going to be a telephone interview in the second half of this show, so in about 10 minutes or so. And Richard Gage was featured in that last audio track I played for you guys. Now, Richard Gage is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 911 Truth. Their website is ae911truth.org. And so that's what we have to look forward to in a short while. I'm going to play a couple tracks to get to take us there. And the first one is, I guess, some Canadiana. I've got I had a real strong passion for Canadian literature for quite a while. Not so much more. I'm you know, clearly more interested in political subjects right now, but at one time. And Al Purdy, a Canadian poet, is speaking about life as a poet. And, you know, I used to liken myself to be a poet, and that was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed that experience. And, you know, a lot of, you know, poetry is, for me, such a powerful tool to, you know, share ideas and emotions and thoughts. And I think poetry is really cool. And Al Purdy seems like a pretty cool, down-to-earth fellow. He spoke to the CBC in 1968. Is when this interview took place. So let's see what a Canadian poet has to say 40 years ago. There you are. I hope you enjoy this.
Al Purdy, editor of The New Romans, a new book of opinion by Canadians about the U.S., is also author of many books, including two volumes of poetry about to hit the market. I asked him if there was any end to his ideas.
I had a period of about 4 months early in the year in which I wrote the most awful tripe. And, of course, some people think I write tripe anyway, but when you think so yourself, it's frightening. I don't suppose I'll stop writing. Heck, I'm nearly 50 now, and I suppose I'll keep on all my life. Well, essentially, what you do with your life seems far more important to me than... You know, I'm going to do what I want with my life. I worked in factories. I've done every sort of thing I can think of previously, but...
You've even been an actor, haven't you?
You heard that, did you? No, I was a drunk in a landing net in the play Mr. Roberts. And I didn't say a word. I was just dragged off the stage. And there are some people also who think I've never recovered from being drunk.
What is your favorite type? I guess it is. Has to be poetry, eh?
Oh, yeah, sure. My favorite... I write the stuff. I've always written the stuff.
Very successfully, too. Governor General's Award in 66 and the President's Medal in 1964.
Yeah, well, those are the trappings.
You don't do it for money. You can't... You can't make money on poetry in Canada, can you?
Oh, sure.
Can you?
Mm-hmm. If you get well-known enough and... And people think you're good. I made $500 a year for many years, and I did it by writing plays for the CBC, not from poetry. If I got $5 for a poem, I was lucky. But now things have changed a bit. We're getting a little bit more culturally, nationally conscious. There is the Canada Council, and every country has sort of a big daddy in the form of an institution like that. There's the Guggenheim in the States, and there are... And also, there are universities who will pay for your worksheets so that I put them in a fireproof place anymore and make sure they're not going to get burned. And you can also get magazines. Some the Toronto Star, for instance, Star Weekly, pays around $100 for a poem. Saturday Night pays $50. You know, it's pretty good.
You pick up a lot of change.
Well, I mean, you don't make a fortune, but you get by on how much money does a man need?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All you need is enough for beer and a few supply of fresh paper and do a little traveling.
I had another poet in here a short while ago, and I asked her what she was trying to say in her poetry, and she says, I don't try to say anything in my poetry. I do that if I want to in prose.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way?
That's putting me on the spot. I don't start out a poem with the idea that I'm going to say anything. It works itself out in the poem, and I don't know what that will be until the poem is over. And it may say nothing, but it may convey a mood. And if conveying a mood is saying something in another way.
Do you sit down with the complete idea in your head to write a poem, or does it come after you write the first word?
Oh, no. I scribble all the time, and better it doesn't work out. But if it's going to work out, it does it on paper. It doesn't do it in my head. I mean, it's a synthesis of writing the poem on paper and in my head at the same time. And it doesn't always happen at once. I change and revise and work and work. It's the same. It isn't the same for other people. They have their own ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to discover the thing on paper.
Yours is your own bag, eh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's mention the books again. The New Romans, Candid Canadian Opinions of the U.S., edited by Al Purdy. Al Purdy, Poems for All the Annettes, and A.W. Purdy, Wild Grape Wine.
Okay, there we are. Al Purdy sounds like a real common man kind of hero fellow. I like that. And... So we're almost going to get ready to get this Richard Gage interview going on. First, I want to play a track. I've played it before, and it's taken from the movie Network, which is from 1976. And the fellow we're going to be talking or doing the speaking, the actor Peter Finch, won the award for this. And this is... this was included in the Zeitgeist production as well. They borrowed... a couple scenes from that movie. The original movie, fantastic. It's about this poor fellow who was a longtime news host, and his life wasn't going too well. And he becomes this mad prophet, screaming about the hypocrisies of our society. Good story, and it talks about media concentration, all aspects of media. It fills in. A lot of ideas went into that, and fantastic movie, Network, if you haven't seen it recently. One of those that seems to be more true now than when it came out in 1976. So let's put that piece on, and after that, hopefully, we'll have Richard Gage joining us from his home in California. So this is a clip from Network via Zeitgeist.
We're in a lot of trouble! Because you people and 62 million other Americans are listening to me right now. Because less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel. The ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And when the largest company in the world controls the most awesome goddamn propaganda force in the whole godless world, who knows what shit will be peddled for truth on this network. So you listen to me. Listen to me. Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You eat like the tube. You raise your children like the tube. You even think like the tube. This is mass madness, you maniacs. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion.
The last thing the men behind the curtain want is a conscious, informed public capable of critical thinking, which is why a continually fraudulent zeitgeist is output via religion, the mass media, and the educational system. They seek to keep you in a distracted, naive bubble, and they are doing a damn good job of it.
I do have on the phone with us Richard Gage. He is a San Francisco-based architect, AIA. His website, ae911truth.org, has been making quite a splash these last couple months. That stands for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard Gage, welcome to the Unbought and Unbossed Show.
Thank you very much, Raymond. It's awesome to be here with you.
Well, thank you. You know, you're going to be in town in Vancouver and Victoria, and the timing seemed right.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I've never been to Vancouver.
Okay. And how about the island? Have you...
Yeah, actually, I did get to go to the island, and I really enjoyed it. That was a vacation a few years back.
Good, good. Well, you know, it seems to me that Dr. Joe Hawkins in Winnipeg invited you up to Canada quite a few months back, and, you know, your name has been... You know, has been a major part of the 9/11 Truth movement since then, if not before. So, welcome back to Canada, I guess.
Thanks. It'll be great to come back. That was almost 2 years ago.
Oh, was it really?
I came to Winnipeg, and I've been traveling all around the America, United States since then, and. We're going to be going to Europe this fall as well. So we're just expanding and getting busier and busier. It just never stops.
Yes. I think things are coming along. They're picking up speed a little bit right now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm excited. I think we're going to bust through into mainstream this year.
So do I. So do I. Listen, can you tell us a little bit of your background? Because, you know, you're often cited as... I guess an expert from a field that, you know, was impacted, you know, with the controlled demolitions or the, you know, global collapse, whatever, whoever wants to call it. You have some expertise in that field. And so can you tell us a little bit about your professional background and maybe bridge that into your website, AE911 Truth, and how that came about?
Sure. I've been an architect for about 20 years. And worked on numerous types of buildings, including institutional and retail and large malls and high schools. Worked on a number of steel-framed, fireproofed buildings. Right now we have a couple of mid-rises in Nevada in a $400 million project that's 1,200 tons of steel framing.
Wow.
So it's very, very, very exciting for us. It's a large project. We have about 30 people working on the team.
Okay.
So that's in construction right now. And so what I've done is about 2 years ago, I was driving down the road on a way to a construction site observation, and I heard on the radio here in town Berkeley, KPFA's Guns and Butter show, which is Bonnie Faulkner's great program here. She interviewed David Ray Griffin, and I couldn't believe it. This is the first time I'd ever heard anything alternative theory. I mean, I'm a Reagan Republican.
Okay.
I have had quite a change of events in my mind around since I started researching 9/11 when this radio interview interfered with my life.
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
2 years ago, he was talking about 118 firefighters and other first responders hearing sounds of explosions, flashes of light, and seeing these debris clouds wrapping all the way around the building symmetrically at the onset of destruction of the two twin towers. And he went on and on, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I had to check this out. So indeed I did, and I was shocked, and I couldn't let it go. And I looked around because it all made sense to me. It began to put all the pieces together in a way I'd never imagined. And the official story made less and less sense the more I looked at it, you know, objectively, critically. So I looked for the other architects and engineers, and I could only find a couple. And I'm going, my God, we have the scholars for 9/11 Truth, the pilots for 9/11 Truth, Marines for 9/11 Truth. Where are the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth? After all, we're the ones that work with buildings.
That's right.
There wasn't any. So I started this website and invited people onto it, and they kept signing up. And I was doing presentations at starting with the firm I worked for. And 15 people came, 14 signed up.
No
kidding.
Before
that, they thought I was a lunatic talking about these conspiracies.
Yeah.
Well, all we talk about now is the forensic-based scientific evidence for the collapse of these three towers, and 95% of the people agree with us that the evidence is solid, and they signed the website, and we now have over 315 architects and engineers demanding a real investigation.
Yeah.
Into these all three high-rise collapses, especially Building 7, which most people don't even know about.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a mystery.
Yeah, indeed. There's lots surrounding Building 7. You know, for example, the BBC announcing that it was that had come down before it had. Yeah, a lot of funny things in the stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
carry on.
Talk about Building 7.
Certainly. Yeah. What can you tell me about Building 7?
Well, this is quite a mystery because we have a 47-story skyscraper, a football field in length away from the North Tower, part of the World Trade Center complex, and it received some damage from World Trade Center North Tower when it came down in the morning. And it had some fires. NIST tells us there were about 8 scattered fires, relatively small, in Building 7, and a lot of smoke on the south side, which was the side that the North Tower was on. And so at 5:20 in the afternoon, this building begins a precipitous, sudden collapse at fairly symmetrically and smoothly into its own footprint virtually.
Mm-hmm.
At almost free fall speed. That is to say, straight down through the path of greatest resistance, the 40,000 tons of structural steel designed to resist this building. Now, how does that happen? Well, you have to destroy the core columns within a tenth of a second of each other for this to occur, and then a half a second later, the perimeter columns. And then you have to repeat that synchronistically timed floor by floor all the way up the building.
Okay.
Or you get a building that falls over. And so this is in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition, where we have a kind of this classic kink in the middle, because the idea of a controlled demolition is to bring the outside of the building in on top of it. And
so as to not damage the buildings in the neighborhood.
That's right.
Yeah.
And create a tidy rubble pile. Well, yeah. You had a 47-story skyscraper that is now only 4 stories high. That to get that degree of compression of the parts of this building, the beams and columns have to be cut. And indeed, we have sounds of explosions heard by witnesses. Craig Bartmer of the New York Police Department is one of them, and another is Kevin Bartner, former Air Force rescue, search and rescue, and he heard not only huge explosions at the onset of this collapse, he heard a countdown on a radio held by a Red Cross worker.
No kidding.
3, 2, 1, kaboom! as he describes it. And your listeners can hear all of this evidence on our website, ae911truth.org. It's all there. Now, here's the problem. We're told this building came down by a normal office fire. NIST stated this on their December 18th update. It's not the damage was inconsequential to the collapse, and diesel fuel in the building was inconsequential to the collapse to the fire. These are normal office fires, and so we have to look at what normal office fires have done to skyscrapers before, and not one skyscraper has ever collapsed due to a normal office fire or any other reason, really. So this is very important background research that needs to be done. Why haven't they collapsed? Well, steel conducts heat rapidly throughout the frame in the building, wicking it away from its source.
It dissipates from where it's hottest. Yeah,
and this building, of course, was not hit by an airplane, so it doesn't have the convenient excuse that the Twin Towers have for the kinetic energy of the airplane knocking off the fireproofing in parts of the building. This is because, so if this is a normal office fire that brought down a 47-story skyscraper in 6.5 seconds, then we have very serious problems with all of our building codes in this country and around the world as well.
That's right. I was going to ask you that question. Remind me, when you finish this piece, I'll get into that idea just quickly.
Okay. Well, here's the bigger problem. At the base of the World Trade Center 7 and the Twin Towers, we have tons of molten iron seen by the first responders and the cleanup iron workers who are the demolition crew is cleaning all this up, flowing like lava, the firemen described it. The World Trade Center structural engineer Leslie Robertson says as of 21 days after the attacks, the molten steel was still running, he says. So this is a big problem because there's dozens of witnesses that have seen this stuff, and we have fires that are only 900 degrees to 1200 degrees Fahrenheit, and yet steel doesn't even begin to melt till about 3000 degrees, or 2700 degrees, almost three times the temperature required that's available due to the fires. Well, how did all this molten metal, which we have these huge chunks of fused molten metal brought up, and they're in museums now, it's very evident. Where does all this come from? Well, Dr. Stephen Jones is sent a 40-pound chunk of it, and he analyzes it. He's a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University. And he finds in the molten metal that it's predominantly iron. It's not steel, so it's not melted steel. It's not aluminum from a jet plane, and it has fluorine and manganese in abundance, and it has iron and aluminum and sulfur. And so these are all the chemical ingredients, and in the right proportion, to suggest that this was the byproduct of an aluminothermic reaction from thermite, which is a high-tech incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And it's not only that. He finds this same substance in the ends of the beams, the slag hanging off the ends of the beams that show cuts from a linear-shaped charge. Specifically designed for thermite with sol gels. In other words, you pack tiny particles of aluminum and iron oxide together with these other minor chemicals and in the sol gel, which binds it together. You pack it in this linear-shaped charge, and you get this cutting ejection through this linear opening, which forces the material through the structural steel. So we have photos of this steel that's been cut in this manner on our website and in our DVD and on our PowerPoint. And we'll be showing this, by the way, to everybody in this dynamic PowerPoint presentation, which, before we forget, is happening in Vancouver and Victoria. Vancouver is Saturday, April 19th,
yep,
at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library.
Have you seen a picture of that building?
No. Is it a nice one?
It's quite interesting. I think you'll appreciate. I think you'll appreciate it. It's quite different.
Thank you for the heads up.
Yeah.
That's great. That's 350 West Georgia Street. I'll look forward to seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day in Victoria, Sunday, April 20th at 2 p.m. at St. John the Divine Church,
mm-hmm,
1611 Quadra Street in Victoria. So anyway, this is very clear evidence, the smoking gun, this thermite residue in the ends of the beams, the previously molten metal, but it's not only there. It's in all of the dust that made it all the way across the river from New Jersey, this thick pyroclastic cloud of concrete. We're talking 90,000 tons of concrete from the World Trade Center North and South Towers, each 90,000 tons. This stuff was pulverized, and we're talking 110 floors, each an acre in size, completely disappeared. There's no floors found at the bottom of either twin tower. They were completely pulverized. There's no trusses underneath them. There's no concrete. There's no steel decking. There's no reinforcing. This must have been some very incredible explosive, in addition, perhaps, to the high-tech super thermite, as it turns out.
Hmm.
What do I mean by that? Which is very explosive in and of itself. The dust is full of these iron-rich microspheres. Each of them, most of them are smaller than a human hair in width. Some of them are up to the size of a BB, but they're almost perfectly round, and there's billions of them. Dr. Jones estimates from the sampling he's taken and extrapolating over the dust that filled the streets and open areas of Manhattan to 4 inches thick all across Manhattan, that there must have been about 10 tons of this of this molten iron that formed itself into these spheres. How? Well, if there were thousands of these thermite cutter charges spaced throughout the columns and beams in the buildings, and this incredible pressure upon its release or explosiveness, because it's nanothermite, very, very, very small particles of aluminum and iron oxide, then the explosiveness would have dispersed the liquid molten iron, which is the byproduct of thermite, into these tiny droplets, and they would have cooled, therefore, into spheres, because the surface tension of drops of liquid airborne forms itself into spheres. And so this also explains why the tops of all the cars in the area were basically toasted, an unexplainable phenomena otherwise in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Jones analyzes these iron-rich microspheres, and he finds that they too have the chemical evidence of thermite. Aluminum, sulfur, manganese, potassium, and other fluorine, and so this is the smoking gun of all smoking guns, because these samples were collected 20 minutes after the collapses all the way over in the Brooklyn Bridge. They were collected two blocks away on top of a high rise and an apartment building, where the windows were all busted out across the street. So this has nothing to do with the cleanup efforts,
mm-hmm,
these iron-rich microspheres. It doesn't stop there, though.
No.
Dr. Jones found about 4 or 5 months ago, inside each of the samplings, these tiny little red chips. He goes, what in the world are these? They respond to a magnet. They have two sides. One side is gray substance, and the other side is this red substance. Well, the red substance is a mixture of iron oxide and aluminum, and two-thirds to one-third, and this is the proportion for thermite. It also has in it the evidence of the other evidence, potassium permanganate, and these other substances, 1,3-diphenylpropane, which is the substance of a sol gel. So it's very, very clearly thermite. In fact, the thermite, you have to ignite it with a very hot substance, like, I don't know, 4,000 degrees. So he achieved that with a laser and set it off, basically proving, in addition to its chemical analysis through X-ray electron dispersive spectroscopy, XEDS.
Wow.
He shows the chemical thermite in its pre-ignited condition in these chips that were about a 16th of an inch large. That was the largest one that he found. So the evidence is quite overwhelming for the use of thermite incendiaries to bring down both the Twin Towers and this mysterious Building 7 that we have not heard at all about
in
mainstream media.
Very little indeed, that's right. Let's, you know, if the towers collapsed the way the Bush administration suggests, what has there been any changes in the construction industry? You know, has there been any changes or studies, to building buildings differently so this wouldn't happen? Or are they just not even mentioning that, you know, these buildings collapsed, and why wouldn't others?
Well, in fact, NIST did make some recommendations for improving the safety of buildings relative to terrorist attacks, but I don't know if that includes upgrading the fire protection of buildings or not. It might, but the American Institute of Architects, of which I'm a member, came out and praised NIST for their research work, but said no, the codes are fine. We don't need any changes in our codes. Thank you very much. So no, there's been no
mass change to how large buildings are built.
No slight changes either. And so this is a gross inconsistency in the treatment of this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I was wondering how deep that went into your field. And it sounds like it didn't. There's been no changes. I read a couple of years back that a insurance company conducted experiments to test steel frame designs, and how they might collapse in the future due to fire damage. And it turned out that none of the different models that they constructed behaved anything like the way the Twin Towers behaved that day. Are there any other similar examples that you're aware of experiments that, you know, they just can't make that happen? Any teams of scientists trying to prove the official story correct, or?
Well, here's what happened. NIST hired Underwriter Laboratories to produce four examples of a mock model of the truss in the World Trade Center, a 35-foot span, and with varying degrees of fireproofing, four different examples. And Kevin Ryan, who was a manager at UL, lost his job as a result of exposing this fact to the public, basically, in an open letter to Frank Gehl at NIST, in which he cites that NIST hired them to do this test, and in fact the test proved that the steel assemblies performed remarkably well under the conditions of ASTM E119, in which there was a 2,000 degree Fahrenheit fire under the truss assemblies, and a twice the known amount of loading on top of the floor that was known to have been in the World Trade Center, and yet it didn't fail.
Yeah.
It sag only 4 inches under these extraordinary circumstances.
Sure, you know that heat being twice what was quoted in the fires.
Yeah.
So wow.
Well, NIST claims that there was an 1800 degree fire, but own metallographic paint analysis performed on steel selected due to its proximity to what they thought would be the hottest fires up near the jet plane impacts proved that there was only a 452 degree maximum core temperatures and 600 degree maximum temperatures outside the core Fahrenheit. So they have no evidence whatsoever to suggest that these were fires that were that hot, far exceeding any known office fire, 1800 degrees. But so Kevin Ryan lost his job exposing these tests. And what does NIST do with these 3 and 4 inch deflections, sags on these trusses? They throw out that experimental data, which they paid I don't know how many million dollars for, and they claim somehow that these trusses sagged 42 inches.
Okay, yeah.
And they use that to suggest that this is the force, the lateral force on the perimeter columns that caused them to pull inward and then fail through buckling or bending, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's this is the kind of scientific method that our tax dollars here in the United States are going for. $20 million and 3 years of study and 10,000 pages of research. And where does all of this end? It ends at the point where the initiation of collapse occurs, where the first truss sags and begins to pull in the first column. The entire report stops at that point.
No kidding, yeah.
And it was. We were told that it was supposed to be the report that would explain the collapse. In fact, that's the title of the report, the final report on the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7. And yet, it's a complete lie. It stops at the what they say initiation of collapse, and then they claim that collapse was inevitable, after that. Why would they stop the entire 10,000-page report before anything really began?
Yeah.
Because had they gone any farther, they would have had to deal with the overwhelming evidence that I have provided to you in part here tonight for explosive controlled demolition.
You were talking about different teams of scientists, and how about a question concerning the different peer-reviewed papers that have been published by supposedly reputable institutions that are backing the official version of events? What do you think is going on there? Last week, I was reading Dave Rovics, a protest folk singer, was saying that there's no way all these scientists could be bought off or whatever, And what you were explaining here is that the initial report suggested something far different than what the final version of the report. Did you have any theories on how it is that there's all these peer-reviewed papers supposedly supporting the official story, and how does that concern the different scientists and the level of perhaps deception up the chain of command? Can you address that, please?
Well, the peer-reviewed papers. I don't know how they get away with producing reports that defy the laws of physics. I can't explain that other than to suggest that perhaps there's a compromise in the system. What do I mean by the laws of physics? We have one paper by Seffen, a gentleman named Seffen from Cambridge in England, that has 15 pages of calculations that would make you turn green.
Okay.
That suggest the following. That this, for instance, in the North Tower, this 15-story section above the point of jet plane impact is going to start a downward descent through 80,000 tons of structural steel designed to resist that load.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to fall at free fall speed as if there were no steel, no floors, no nothing underneath it. Let's try to put this in even greater perspective, because people with a sixth grade education in physics can comprehend this. We take a 15-story building. We hold it up with a crane 95 stories above the ground. And right next to it, we hold another identical 15-story building with a big crane, and we support it over a 95-story building with 95,000 tons of structural steel underneath it. And we're going to pull the lever on these cranes and drop both of these 15-story buildings. Now, I'm going to ask your listeners, which one hits the ground first? The one with nothing under it, or the one with 80,000 tons of structural steel designed to lift, to resist that load?
Yeah. Good point.
It's pretty clear. Most everybody raises their hand in these presentations and says, of course, the one without any resistance. Well, NIST tells us, and Cefn is proving it with his calculations,
mm-hmm.
that they both hit the ground at the same time, and all of us know that's impossible. Now, this peer-reviewed paper has been torn apart by several other papers that you can find on our website in the technical articles section of ae911truth.org. Indeed,
the website you're talking about, the technical that you've added to the website?
Yeah, it's on the left side. I was going to mention something else about this free fall speed, and it slipped me. Peer-reviewed papers. Dr. Jones, speaking of peer-reviewed papers, has submitted his evidence for extremely high temperatures, in other words, molten iron,
mm-hmm.
in these microspheres, to a couple of scientific journals, and they are being peer-reviewed, and they're set to be published this month.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very exciting news for those of us who have been looking for our own set of peer-reviewed papers.
Excellent.
To sum that point up.
Fantastic. What I'm thinking is I'm going to cut to a station identification and a quick one-minute song. Are you okay to hang on, and then we'll continue on after that?
You bet. I'll be right here.
Okay. Thank you. Friends, we are listening. We are speaking with Richard Gage, AIA, an architect, one of the persons behind the AE911Truth.org, which is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We will be back right after this song.
People always put me down because the things I say are not real smart. I got these guys to help me lead this nation. Talking about my the guys I work with. Oh, yeah, my administration, baby. We started off going into Afghanistan. We shifted the blame and put it on Saddam Hussein. The media perpetuates a terrorization. Hey, I said it. So we can pass draconian bad laws.
I'm George W. Bush, leader of the free world. I want to bomb Iraq. And when the world says no, I say, yeah, whatever. Saddam has started to meet our demands. Yeah, whatever. I talked to Colin Powell. He said,
sir, maybe we should give the inspectors more time.
I said, no, you know why?
Because it's my United States of whatever. Yeah. And this is my United States. Whatever.
President Bush?
Hush up. Don't talk to me now. United States of
whatever. Leave it to me. Hello.
Russia will veto war.
I see. Wham! Mr. President, North Korea's got nukes.
Oh, ding dong dong ding ding dong dong. Translation?
Whatever!
I am Bin Laden. You still have not caught me.
I'm George W. You know what the W stands for? Yet.
Okay, hey, what was that craziness? That was Whatever by Liam Lynch. And before that, we heard a version of My Generation by Dave Von Kleist. Funny stuff. Well, I don't know. Funny is as funny does, maybe, but scary stuff as well. And we're talking about a rather scary subject right now, the official story of what happened with 9/11. We're talking with Richard Gage, AIA, an architect with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard, are you there? Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be back.
All righty. Now, one of the things I want to ask you is, how is it that now you've been making the claim that, you know, explosives, thermite, you know, has been found, you know, likely the guilty party there is that incendiary. How is it possible that those explosives could have ended up in this building, or buildings, I should say, the three of them that were demolished that day? Can you talk on that, please?
Yeah, well, looking at the Twin Towers first, it turns out that this building was unique in the history of skyscraper construction. The core structure where it had all the elevators grouped around all of the core columns, which allowed for the remainder of the building to be basically open office without this forest of columns that was typically in the skyscrapers of the time. And so it won several awards, by the way, for this, as well as for its strength, because the perimeter columns had these exoskeletons, exoskeleton-type bearing wall is virtually what it was.
Right.
Anyway, if somebody could have gotten access to the elevator hoistways, and hacked through the two layers of three-quarter-inch gypsum board, then they could have planted these explosives on the columns quite easily without anybody in the building knowing it. Well, I should say any of the occupants. Of course, they would have had to have access through security, and which is why all of us in the 9/11 Truth Movement are calling for an independent investigation, not only about the building collapses and the forensic evidence there, but the security company, which was Securicom, who on its board of directors was Marvin Bush, actually, George Bush's younger brother. So we would like to see him be asked some questions under oath. But also, it turns out that there was an elevator modernization going on the 9 months prior to 9/11, when all the elevators in turn were locked down, and there was lots of work going on, and in fact, there was a lot of problems with white dust throughout the building, which may very well have been gypsum board powder. So this is a possibility. Ace Elevator had this contract. It's just one possibility. In fact, it turns out that the entire World Trade Center complex was sold 6 weeks prior to 9/11. To private hands, Larry Silverstein, who we would also like to see questioned under oath. There's a lot of key questions for him. In fact, he said on public television regarding Building 7, maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. He was talking to the fire commander. And so he said they gave that order and we watched the building come down. Well, you don't give such an order to pull a building, which means to demolish it in the terms of the industry, the explosive demolition industry, on an afternoon. This takes months of planning to set up these explosives and engineer them. Well, Larry came back later suggesting that he meant pull the firemen out of the building.
Yeah.
But NIST and FEMA both tell us that there was no firefighting effort in Building 7, so there was nobody to pull out.
That's right.
And he didn't use that term, pull them out. He said pull it.
Yeah, it.
So
yeah.
Very, very, very curious.
There were also power downs in the weeks previous to the collapse. You know, not the 9 months back that you mentioned. There was also more recent ones as well.
Yeah. Well, we understand that Scott Forbes from Fiduciary Trust, who operated in the South Tower, said that they did power down the top floor, the top 50 floors of the South Tower the weekend prior to 9/11, when he said a lot of workmen were bringing in, running a lot of wires and so forth. So that was certainly suspicious, but I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah.
Because we don't have anybody else suggesting that happened, and it was only one half of one of the two buildings.
Right. So okay.
I don't talk about it too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, that's a good point. How do you personally, decide what is, relevant evidence that's backed with enough critical, and constructive thought? How do you gauge yourself on what you include in your presentations? Is there a methodology that you follow?
Well, we're architects and engineers, the 315 of us so far, demanding a real investigation based on what is science-based forensic evidence. We are not conspiracy theorists. And so we really do try to stick to that evidence, which will hold up in a court of law.
Okay.
That is indisputable, such as, for instance, these series of explosions that occur 20, 40, and 60 stories below the collapsing wave in each of the twin towers. These occur at 160 to 200 feet per second. These are propelled by explosives. These speeds, this is not air
rushing
being
wind,
pushed
yeah.
down by the 15-story building, which, by the way, completely disappears in the first 4 seconds. There's nothing driving the building down after that 4 seconds. In all the videos, all you see is the building tearing itself apart. But anyway, these squibs occur halfway between the corners of the buildings on the facade. It's a geometrically precise series of locations, and indicating an engineered event, not a natural event. And also, they only blow out one or two windows. It's highly focalized.
Yes.
This isn't the result of air pressure coming into an open office space from the elevator hoistway being compressed by this building up above, which doesn't exist.
Sure. And what does that suggest to you?
Huh?
What's causing that?
Well, it appears to be explosives
yeah.
based on the speeds they come out of the buildings.
Yeah.
And they're pulverized building materials, not puffs of air, as NIST suggests.
Mm. Yeah. You were speaking earlier that you're working on a project right now, a large one, and that partly answers this question, as I want to know how you're speaking out on behalf of 9/11 Truth and getting some these pertinent questions answered. How is that affecting your career?
Well, it takes a lot of time to travel around the country every 2 weeks and do an average of one other presentation in between. And,
okay.
So I'm not able to work on Fridays as a result. So I work 4 days a week, and we have a great need for volunteers to assist us with verifying the architects and engineers, because that's our greatest asset, and we prize that asset and verify them very carefully. And even the 1,300 others, we have a verification process. So we need help with things like that and other activities such as marketing our word, because I can't do it all We have maybe a dozen volunteers right now, and we can't do it all. There's too much work here. So it has cut into my my workload at work, and as a result, we have what we call a sustaining membership, and we ask for assistance from our members and others who are interested in assisting us in getting this word out and getting a real investigation going. People can become a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. So we highly encourage people to support us in that manner, as well as signing our petition and sending the AE911truth.org link to every architect and engineer that people can find and everyone else that they know, because this is a grassroots movement, and it spreads because of conviction and love of the truth and love of our country. And Canada is under as much besieged as much as the United States is right now. The freedoms are in grave jeopardy.
Indeed.
In Canada.
Yeah.
Speak more about that.
Sure. I spoke on that earlier tonight. I guess where I was going with that question was, you are still a working and productive member of society, and that being, you have not been blacklisted.
Oh, no. No, indeed. I haven't received any threats or anything like that.
Okay. I'm trying to get some encouragement to let other professionals, in relevant fields, you know, to start throwing their hat in, because it you know, it's time and it's needed, and so yeah, I was hoping.
Well, I should add that we did have the dubious honor of having our website being shown on the floor of Congress in a PowerPoint provided by the Simon Wiesenthal Center.
That's right.
Coached by the RAND Corporation in a subcommittee of the Homeland Security Department, and this is the Homegrown Terrorism Act is what they were trying to sell to other congressmen. And so they were showing all of these jihadi websites and Taliban websites, and right in between those, they sandwich architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth,
mm-hmm.
which makes no sense whatsoever. This is a group, a peaceful group. All we're doing is asking science-based questions about the collapses of the World Trade Center
on
9/11. And so we wrote the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Mark Weitzman in particular, the presenter of this. We demanded a retraction, an apology, and more importantly, actually, an explanation as to what in the world was he thinking, putting our website up there, right sandwiched in between all of these violent, militant websites. I mean, what is the possible motivation here other than to brand us as terrorists? This is one of the very disturbing development in which can only show an intent of stopping dissent and the real raising of questions in our country about our government's activities. And I say our government because while we don't have all the answers, and we don't have a lot of the answers about who may have been responsible for these controlled demolitions of these three high-rise buildings and the murder of over 2,700 people in them, it's pretty clear that this was not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda did not have access to these buildings. I think that's a reasonable assumption, and they did not have access to super high-tech thermite. The stuff's not available on eBay or through. This is developed in Lawrence Livermore Laboratory.
Yeah.
This extremely nano-sized particles of highly reactive thermite. So we're talking about some sort of an inside job here. We're all very, very concerned about that. How do we? I mean, who? Why would somebody have done this? Well, you We want a real investigation to follow the money.
Yeah.
It turns out there's a lot of money to follow. There's millions made on stock market put options on these faded airliners, for instance, that fell in value greatly the next day. And the money trail goes on and on.
Yeah, we
invaded two countries in which over 1 million people have already perished and gained regional hegemony, which is a goal of the Project for a New American Century, the think tank associated with the neocons currently in power.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten a response from Simon Wiesenthal? Have they gotten back to you on your request?
No.
Okay. Nothing at all?
No. We'd sure like to have a response.
Tell me, what's... Now, you're out of the Bay Area, and, of course, that's... famous for its counterculture and certainly kind of the 60s image of war protest and is the Bay Area still a magnet for that? What's going on in your hometown?
Well, Berkeley is where I spend a lot of time, and unfortunately, it's not like what it was back in the 60s, which shut down. I think it was primarily responsible, at least for initiating or a substantial component of the shutting down of the Vietnam War. Today it is fairly limited activity, and there's been some protests in San Francisco that are sizable, nothing that approaches what's required in order to get our leaders to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
We are just about out of time, as a matter of fact. Are there any parting thoughts, any words of wisdom for the truth movement listening in? How would you like to finish the interview?
I would like to exhort all of your listeners to, with me, get off our rear ends and take some action based on this science-based forensic evidence, and email our link, ae911truth.org, to everybody you know, and specifically every architect and engineer in Canada and around the world, because without 1,000 architects and engineers, we're barking up a tree. We need numbers and numbers of these credentialed individuals to turn the heads in our Congress and to get something done. This is a grassroots movement, and if every one of your listeners don't act, we don't have a lot of hope in turning this around. And what we're trying to turn around is to stop another 9/11, which our government is basically promising us, more like a threat. And if they did one, whoever did this, if they did one 9/11, they certainly are capable of doing another one, and we are trying to stop it, and trying to stop an invasion of Iran in the process. Doing it, they may pull another false flag operation, which this was, and blame it on Iran, which they desperately are trying to get into, if you listen to any of the military officials that are coming out of the administration now.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to stay optimistic, even though my heart isn't always there. But that's what I've got to do. And I want to thank you for spending your time and your energy and your expertise and putting it to this use. It is greatly appreciated. I want to let you know that Canada has a pretty strong truth movement, and you're going to meet some wonderful people next week when you're up here.
Great. So, I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you, Richard Gage. Thank you for joining me. Thank you.
Hey, you're very welcome. And you might just let your listeners know where we'll be on Saturday and Sunday.
I will. I've been working on that announcement for a couple of weeks now.
Oh, great.
You
Thanks
betcha.
A lot. I appreciate it, Raymond.
Thank you. Take
you're
care.
Welcome. Bye.
Hey, there it is. There it is. Richard Gage. He will be in Vancouver April 19th at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Public Library. The next afternoon at 2 p.m. he will be in Victoria at St. John the Diviner at 1600 Quadra Street. You have been listening to Unbought and Unbossed on CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. We're going to take you now to Terrence McKenna. You guys have a good week out there.